Hey there, listeners. I don't know about you, but I am serious about my sleep. And I have to tell you, the best way to get a good night's sleep is on a good quality set of sheets. This is when you need perfect linens. Trust me when I tell you, these are the most comfortable, luxurious sheets I have ever experienced. And I want you to enjoy them as well. Now, if you head on over to battleforliberty.com/sheets and use my promo code, that's PerfectLinens20, all one word, PerfectLinens20, you'll receive $20 off an order of $125 or more. So head on over right now to battleforliberty.com/sheets and use promo code PerfectLinens20. They have a utility that will help you pick the perfect set tailored specifically to your tastes and needs. And they offer free shipping within the continental U.S. There is no reason not to check this out. battleforliberty.com/sheets. The Battle for Liberty, episode 51.
This is the Battle for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Battle for Liberty. Once again, I'm your host, Mike Tilden. Thanks so much for joining me on the podcast dedicated to the journey of the libertarian novice. Don't ever miss an episode of The Battle for Liberty. Make sure you're subscribed on iTunes and Stitcher. That way, every episode will be delivered to your device with no effort required. It couldn't be easier. All right, well, I have a wonderful episode for you today. I've been looking forward to this episode for quite some time. I'm privileged to be talking with Nick Gosling, the executive director of the Libertarian Christian Institute. Nick holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in history and a master's degree in Christian and Classical Studies. He's previously been a business executive, a consultant, and he's served in political party leadership. He's a serial entrepreneur and has co-founded several businesses in various fields involving finance, perishable goods, wholesale, distribution, and transportation. He's obviously very experienced and very knowledgeable, and today he's going to help me understand a little bit more about where libertarianism and Christianity intersect. So without further ado, Nick, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here.
Thanks so much for coming on. Thanks for being here. I have to say right from the very beginning, ever since I found the Libertarian Christian podcast, I've been a routine listener. It combines two aspects of my life that fascinate me the most, namely Christianity and libertarianism. So I've been eager to get you on the show to help my listeners and really to help me understand better where these two just massive topics intersect. So before I fire off questions specifically about libertarianism and Christianity specifically, can you tell us and my listeners about the Libertarian Christian Institute itself, kind of its history, its founding, what its mission is?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Libertarian Christian Institute grew out of libertarianchristians.com. After 2008, the first time that Barack Obama was elected president, Norman Horn, who is our founder and chairman and president, he set out to just sort of create a website to put down his own thoughts kind of on paper and see if anyone else was thinking the same way. And that was libertarianchristians.com. And over the years, he got a lot of traction. It kept growing. There was more and more people who expressed interest. And it was a couple of years ago that he started speaking to, he was speaking with Alexander McCubbin, who is the co-founder and first CEO of Students for Liberty. And Alexander and Norman had been friends, and Norman was part of Students for Liberty. And he said, hey, I want to create an organization out of libertarianchristians.com that basically is for the purpose of promoting libertarian thought amongst Christians. And Alexander says that's a great idea. And from that, they formed what is now the Libertarian Christian Institute, which is a registered 501c3. It has been for about 2 years now. And then I came on as executive director a little bit under a year ago. And so we are growing programs. We know we're fundraising in order to be able to do more. We have our podcast, which you mentioned earlier. We have our academic journal that we're launching The first volume will publish in January, and that is to reach scholars and theologians and future pastors and priests with libertarian Christian thought. We are representing at different events in the Liberty Movement, and eventually we'll also be at events in just general Christian conferences and things of that sort to represent libertarian thought. And so we're growing out our programs, we're growing out our base and our influence, and you know, we've got a lot of great feedback. People really appreciate that we're out there and that we're helping them to synthesize their Christianity with libertarian thought.
Yeah, I have to echo that statement as well. I've been a Christian my entire life, and it's always been an important part of my life. But for a little while, I think this is a very common story, especially for someone going off to college. You know, it kind of took a backseat in my life. I'm a little bit ashamed to admit that now, but I think that's fairly common. And I got far more into politics, and I would say over the last probably 5 years. Hilariously coinciding with when I married a very faithful woman, Christianity became much more important in my life. And so when I found the intersection of these two very important things to me, I was very happy that I found it. And then being that I host a podcast, I found that you had a podcast, and I went, oh man, this is phenomenal. So let's jump right into really what I want to talk about for the rest of the show. And I have, you know, a couple questions that stray from this theme, but I think that generally this is what we're gonna talk about. I'd like for us to get all on the same page and go back to basics. I want to start out with what I think is perceived as a very common dilemma for libertarianism and Christianity. And then afterwards, once you help me define what that dilemma is, then I want to get your response to it. So first and foremost, I think the basic question has to be, what is it about libertarianism that leads, I think, a lot of people to believe that its political philosophy is somehow incompatible with Christianity?
Well, I think there's at least two things. Number one is that there's this perception that if you're a libertarian, that is a comprehensive worldview. And I suppose if you're an objectivist, you know, following in the steps of Ayn Rand, that is a comprehensive worldview. There are people who, you know, try to synthesize objectivism with Christianity also, and I honestly haven't dove that deep into that particular topic. But, you know, I'm not an objectivist, and most people in our organization are not objectivists. And so we don't view libertarianism as a comprehensive worldview. Libertarianism is just one part of our worldview, and it specifically has to do with our political ethics. So if you take libertarianism as if it were some kind of comprehensive lens through which you view the entire world, and then you draw inaccurate conclusions out of that, like, oh, if you're a libertarian, that must mean that you think it's okay, ethically, to just do anything, abuse heroin or whatever, and that's totally fine. You must think that if you're a libertarian. Well, no. Libertarianism is simply the non-aggression principle. It means that we don't use political violence against people for activity that does not hurt someone else. That doesn't mean that what they're doing is good. It doesn't mean it's not sinful. It doesn't mean we have to approve of it. It doesn't mean that we can't condemn it and call them to repentance. It just means we're not going to use the state and legislation to try to force them to do what we want. And when you look at the New Testament, that is the overwhelming method through which the kingdom of God changes the hearts and minds of men. It's not through, let's take over Rome's government and use the Roman sword to create a Christian world. That's completely opposite of what Jesus said to do. It's you use the church, you use ministry, you use prayer, love and service to your neighbor, and you trust in God's power to change hearts and save lives and ultimately lead people to saved souls. That's the intersection of Christianity and libertarianism. It's when we combine Christianity with political power and try to make it like as if Jesus is just Caesar holding a cross, that's a completely erroneous theology, and it leads us to all kinds of tragic conclusions, which we've seen time and time again throughout the history of the church.
Yeah, I think you touched on something that is so important there that I have found myself explaining to people on social media and in person, and that is that there is so much more to a good and moral life than the non-aggression principle. And certainly the non-aggression principle is a fantastic way to frame out the allocation of scarce resources. And I think we'd probably agree on that. But too many people, I feel, say, well, if it doesn't violate the non-aggression principle, then it must be moral. And the classic example I give to contradict that is prostitution. I use it all the time because I think you can make a solid case that voluntary prostitution does not violate the non-aggression principle, but it is absolutely immoral and should be discouraged, and anyone practicing it should be coached and encouraged to stop. And I think that's what I'm hearing you say. Is that right? That there's more to this life than the non-aggression principle.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, whether it's prostitution or the drug war or any number of other things, there's lots of things that people can do in this life that don't directly harm others, but that doesn't mean they're good. They could be self-destructive. They could have a negative impact on that person's family, their community, their church, whatever. That doesn't mean those things are good. No, we shouldn't approve of them. We have the right to speak out against them. And as the church, we must speak out against them. And actually, I was giving a talk recently, and I kind of made this point because, you know, right now in this country, we're going through this whole crisis of free speech where there's massive censorship going on, and everybody's trying to censor everybody else. And, you know, if you deviate from the party line, even a quarter of an inch, you get called a Nazi or any, like, it's insane what's going on that we're arguing over the right to free speech in 2017. But the point I made in this talk I gave recently is that the right to free speech also entails the right to say things that offend other people. There is no right to not be offended. And so if a Christian gets up and says, hey, prostitution's bad, you shouldn't do that, well, that's probably going to offend some people. But that's okay, right? Free speech, you don't have a right to not be offended. You have a right to say things that offend other people. And the gospel can be offensive at times, but that doesn't mean we don't say it. So I guess the point I'm making here is that the non-aggression principle, you know, again, like you just said, it doesn't mean that we approve of what people are doing. As Christians, we need to speak out for righteousness. The operative point is we just don't go try to use political power and Caesar's sword to force that on other people. Number one, it doesn't really work. And number two, it's offensive to the one thing that can actually help them, which is the gospel.
Yeah, I think that's a really a powerful thing you just said. So as libertarians, another thing I want to tackle with you while we have you is we consistently advocate for the respect of the individual over the collective. Is it possible to avoid collectivist thinking while simultaneously submitting yourself to Christ's church?
You know, I think we need to distinguish between the collectivism that can come about in the theological side and what we're talking about in the political sphere. So, yeah, when you look at Christian history and you look at biblical theology, I mean, you can't live the Christian life alone, right? I mean, so we're not meant to do that. The church is a body. It's a family. It's the family of God. And putting an overly individualized lens on it, it doesn't work. That's not how it's meant to be. But to then take that and argue for some kind of theological progressivism, which is what a lot of people on the theological left do, is they take these principles that are meant to apply to the church, or in some cases the family, but mainly the church, and they extrapolate them to society at large, and then infer that, oh, well, the state should get involved to make sure everybody has universal health care and everybody has, you know, minimum wage and all these leftist policies that economically just don't work. I mean, they're intrinsically untenable. They cannot work. They'll never work. They never have worked. We're seeing what's happening in Venezuela right now. But that's because there's a distinction between what we do voluntarily as the church, which requires an emphasis on community, and what we do as a political unit or political society, where the rights of the individual are paramount.
Yeah, I think for me, what kind of cinches that issue is that, you know, when we think politically, The collectivism that I think libertarians want to avoid is the forced, sometimes by physical violence, the forced collectivism, whereas I don't see anything in the Bible or in Christ's teaching that, say, force these people to convert. It's all done through through voluntary persuasion. Is there something to that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you think of Christ on trial in front of Pontius Pilate, and Pilate is quizzing him on the nature of his kingship. And he says, if my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight, that I wouldn't be handed over. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this world. And then in the same vein, even a little bit earlier in the narrative, you know, we see Peter taking his sword and striking at the temple guard, and he's rebuked by Jesus. So the point there is that the kingdom of God does not come through the sword. It doesn't come through coercion. In fact, I mean, if you try to force conversions at the point of the sword, you're going to get a lot of inauthentic conversions. I mean, this is what a lot of other religions and sadly many times Christianity throughout history has also tried to do. But it doesn't work. I mean, it produces hypocrites. Real conversion has to come from the Holy Spirit. It has to come from the heart. You can't legislate making someone a Christian. And at worst, is if you try to legislate them to comply to all of Christian ethics, what ends up happening is they become resentful and they don't really acknowledge their sin and they never end up repenting, and thus you're pushing them farther away from Christ.
That's very interesting. I hadn't thought about the rebukement of St. Peter. I hadn't thought about that. Let's talk a minute specifically about the non-aggression principle. We talk a lot about the non-aggression principle in the libertarian universe, but I hear all the time, well, the non-aggression principle can't possibly be right because there's so much violence in the Bible. You know, you see it everywhere in the Old Testament and then also sporadically in the New Testament, even after the coming of Jesus. Doesn't that contradict the non-aggression principle? Doesn't that teach us that violence is inherently necessary?
Well, there's two things that could be said to that. So the first way I'd look at it is actually Bob Murphy, who's a fantastic Christian libertarian thinker and economist, gave a talk at our conference last year, and one of the things he addressed is how do you square Rothbardian theory of natural law and property rights with Christian thinking and non-aggression and all these sorts of things. And so, I mean, his point was that, okay, well, if God is creator, then he is the rightful ultimate property owner of everything. And so you can't say your property rights are being aggressed against by God because you're God's property. He's the creator. He can do whatever he wants with his creation. So
that's an interesting.
Sorry,
I don't mean to interrupt. That's a fascinating take. I hadn't read that piece. Go on. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, no problem. It was actually a lecture he gave at our conference in 2016, and so that would be if you're looking at it through kind of the traditional lens of Christian interpretation on these things, you might look at it that way. Now, recently on our show, we also had on Greg Boyd, and I'm currently working through his new academic book, Crucifixion of the Warrior God, and he's arguing from a very ancient kind of interpretive thesis, relying on theologians like Origen and others who were kind of early pioneers of allegorical interpretation. And he's arguing that essentially the violent depictions of God in the Old Testament were how Israel interpreted God to be. But when we look at Christ, who is the perfect, final, and full revelation of how God actually is, that has to be the guiding interpretive view of how we look at how God is Christ, and not anything that came before that, because that's a lesser or incomplete revelation. So I'm not going to get into the debate on what I think about that thesis. I will be doing that review for our academic piece, which is coming out in several months. For our academic journal, but that's another way of looking at it that has some historical basis. So whether you want to look at it that way or you want to look at it in the first way I described, the kind of God is the ultimate property owner anyway sort of way, either way, there's no conflict to the non-aggression principle.
That's great. I'm going to go ahead and link to that, the Crucifixion of the Warrior God, on the show notes page, as well as everything else we've talked about so far. So listeners, if you want to check any of this stuff out, it's battleforliberty.com/51, battleforliberty.com/51. So all of that will be linked there. Okay, so let's move on a little bit and talk specifically about taxation. And, you know, I'm sure you're probably sick to death of answering this question, but we're going to ask you to do it again. What about render unto Caesar? Well, how do we handle that, you know, we should be rendering unto Caesar what is Caesar's? Doesn't that mean taxation? Isn't that exactly what Christ meant?
So I think the primary problem that people run into when they're trying to interpret this passage is they just pull that one little verse out of context, and they're not reading the whole narrative of the passage. So you have to remember that what's going on in the first century at the time Jesus is living and ministering is the Jews had been under Roman oppression for quite some time, and prior to that they'd been under oppression by the Macedonians, by the Medo-Persians, by the Babylonians. So they've really been under foreign imperial rule for centuries. And several of the groups in what we call Second Temple Judaism, that is Judaism around the time of the Second Temple, several of the groups that were around, I mean, everyone's familiar with the Pharisees because they're in the New Testament. Most are probably also familiar with the Sadducees. Other prominent groups were the Essenes and the Zealots. And the Zealots were those who were trying to get the Jews to lead a military revolt against Rome, basically to follow the lead of Judas Maccabeus, who was a very famous Jewish figure several centuries before Christ, and lead a military revolt against Rome to reconquer Israel for the Jews. And so that's kind of the backdrop of what's going on in this passage. So the religious leaders, they come to Jesus, and you read the text, and it says they're trying to ensnare him with their words. They're trying to trap him. So if Jesus says, oh, yeah, the tax is good, just pay the tax, well, that would have immediately made him look like a sellout to all the people he was ministering to, the masses who hated Rome, they resented Rome. At the same time, if he goes, no, resist the tax, don't pay it, he would have immediately been arrested as seditious against the Roman government. So what he does is he throws the question back on them. They try to trip him up, and he throws it back on them by saying, okay, well, consider what really is Caesar's, what really is God's. And then you read the end of the passage, and it says, and they marveled at his answer. So it's completely illogical the way most people view this passage to say, oh, yeah, Jesus is just saying the tax is good, pay the tax. That's not what he's saying. No one would have marveled at that answer. And in fact, if he had said that, many of the people he was trying to reach would have stopped listening to him. So he doesn't actually answer the question at all there. He throws it back on the people to consider what really does belong to God and where do their loyalties and their priorities in this life actually lay. Now, I do think you can make an argument from parallel passages that, yeah, Christians should pay their taxes, but it's not because the tax is good and it's not because the tax is rightfully owed. It's because being a tax resister is not our mission in life. Our mission in life is to glorify God, spread the gospel, love our neighbor. But if you look at like these parallel passage where they're talking about the temple tax, and Jesus says, you know, tell me from who do the kings of the earth collect their tribute, from their sons or from others? And they go, oh, well, from others. And he says, well, then the sons are free. Nevertheless, so as to not give offense, go fishing and pull out this fish and you'll find the coin in the mouth to pay the tax and then go pay it. So the point he's making is that, yes, we should pay our taxes, but it's not because the tax is good. It's not because the tax isn't theft. It's because getting arrested as a tax protester is not God's will for your life. God wants you to be out ministering and spreading the gospel and not being caught up in these little political minutiae.
That is fast. You've given me something to think about. It had not been put that way to yet. See, I'm a pretty outspoken advocate that taxation is theft and that we should be fighting for the reduction of all taxes. And, you know, obviously in an ideal world, I'm not so naive as to think that will ever happen in my life. But I hadn't thought about it that way. So is what you're saying that there's evidence to believe that Christ's point was, look, I'm not saying it's right or that it's just, but you're not going to do me or anyone else or your neighbors any good if you're behind bars.
Yeah. And I mean, Matthew 22, which is the rendered to Caesar passage, I mean, it that's where he's basically throwing the question back on them theologically. So, but I think you can derive that principle from the parallel passages like the discussion on the temple tax. And then we see the same principle in Romans, you know, and that's, I mean, one of the other things that comes up all the time in these discussions is Romans 13. Well, if you look at the whole context of Romans, you know, Paul's concern isn't saying, oh yeah, government's good and everything it does is good, and so just, you know, obey the government all the time and it's all great. Paul's point is, by the sovereignty of God, there are governments in the world, and no matter what they do and no matter who they are, they aren't operating outside of God's plan. But if you try to go, and keep in mind he's writing to Christians living in Rome. This is Rome that murdered Christ and went on to murder most of the apostles, including Paul himself, and ultimately destroy the temple in AD 70. This is the government he's talking about. He's saying, you know, don't be a resistor. Consider yourself under this system in the sense that it's there, and God is sovereign over it, and he's going to use it for his purposes. It doesn't mean that what they're doing is good. It just means it's not your place to be a revolutionary and try to overthrow it. Trust that God is in charge, and ultimately he's going to put all rival reign under his feet.
That is fascinating. To me, it sounds like a plea to remember your priorities. What do you think about that?
I think that's absolutely a fantastic way of putting it.
Okay. Like I said, you've given me a lot to think about with those last two. It's almost like you were reading my mind, because my last question was, what about Romans 13? And you transitioned for me beautifully. So that is great info. So now what I'm going to do, I have some patrons on my Patreon website who have given some listener questions, and I want to make sure that we handle those. So if you're up for it, let's take just a couple quick listener questions.
Let's go for it.
All right. So from Rip in Philadelphia, he asks, and I think this is a very difficult question, and we'll see how you handle it. If Jesus was alive today, would he be a libertarian?
I suppose the questioner's not here, so we can't ask him what he means by that. But if you mean like if he would be registered in the Libertarian Party, I would say probably not. But if you're
I agree with you 100%, and I am fascinated to hear what your reasoning is. So go.
Okay. Well, every time we try to paint Jesus into a political box, like Jesus would be a Republican or Jesus would be a Democrat or Jesus would be a registered libertarian. No, Jesus is king. Jesus is the king. Jesus is a monarchist. And Christianity, fundamentally, we may be libertarians as far as we relate to other humans, but as we relate to God, we're monarchists. We have one king, and it's King Jesus. So to put Jesus in this idea that he's going to get behind a certain political public policy platform in the traditional sense, I think is totally erroneous. I mean, and I'm reminded of this story out of the Old Testament, you know, where Joshua is talking to the angel of the armies of the Lord, and he goes, "Are you for us or for our enemies?" And he goes, "No, I'm here representing Yahweh. So I'm not for you or for your enemies. I'm representing God. Who's king?" So that's how I'd look at it. I would say that as far as our political philosophy, Jesus commands us to be small L libertarian for all the kinds of reasons that we were just talking about, plus many, many more. But that doesn't mean that Jesus himself is a quote-unquote libertarian. Jesus is God. He's king. He's Lord.
Yeah, I you said it way better than I would have, but for the exact same reason, I would say no. I don't think he would be any sort of political opinion. I wouldn't have put it just because I didn't think of it that he's the monarchy. Of course, he's the king, but I hadn't thought of it that way. But I do agree with it. So that was good. Okay, the next listener question, and this one is long, so it's going to be the last. So Matt from Pittsburgh asks. As I understand it, libertarianism's main tenets are, at bottom, moral claims. The principles of non-aggression and of natural property rights both essentially claim that there are acts which are clearly moral and acts which are clearly immoral. Mainly, that it is always wrong to commit aggressive acts against peaceful people. Since many scholars have made the point that absolute morality requires the existence of a deity, is atheism compatible with libertarianism? To me, it seems that they are mutually exclusive.
Okay, so to an extent, this has to do with this discussion on positive and negative rights and positive and negative law. You know, there's all of modern statism is built on this kind of theory of positive law and positive rights, by which they go around and legislate all these obligations that we have to the quote unquote collective.
Can you actually just explain that real quick? We do talk about that on this show, but as this show is dedicated to the journey of the libertarian novice, people who are brand new to it, will you just very, very briefly run us through what is a positive right versus a negative right?
Okay, so the essence of a negative right is basically what you have the right to be protected from, which is namely aggression and the plundering of your property and things of that sort. The positive law is this legal theory that you have affirmative obligations to the political sphere, the political unit, the political society, which can be coercively extracted out of you. And this would be things like paying taxes or being conscripted into military service or any number of other things for the quote-unquote good of the collective, the good of society. Well, the natural rights theory is not centered on positive law. It's centered on negative law. It's all these things that basically have to do with what you have the right to be protected against. You have the right to be protected against robbery and violence and force and the plundering of your property. And this flows from this idea of self-ownership, and therefore your labor and the things you create with your labor are also your rightful property. Now, to dive into the other side of the question, you know, there are many libertarian theorists who do approach it from utilitarianism, which is basically this idea that we should do the greatest good for the greatest number, or some other spin on positive law. For example, Ludwig von Mises was not a natural rights theorist. He was more of a positivist, and yet he still got to libertarianism because he thought it was the optimal system for the best good for the greatest number, which I would say it is, but that's not really the point. And Murray Rothbard, who was an agnostic but had a lot of Roman Catholic friends and other Christian friends, he did have a theory of natural rights, which he expounds in The Ethics of Liberty and other books. But can you logically ultimately get there without God? I would say no. I think all ethics devolves from the fact that God is God. And so that obviously I have significant philosophical differences with my atheist libertarian friends, of which I have a number. Now, I'm glad they're libertarians. I'm glad we can work together, and they've done some fantastic work, and you know, working alongside them, we've made positive contributions to the world. But ultimately, no, I don't believe you can have a truly consistent, logically consistent ethical system apart from God.
Yeah, I have to say I agree with that completely. I count myself among the natural rights libertarians. Not that I don't have just massive amounts of respect for people like Mises, and even, you know, Milton Friedman, who I would classify as a utilitarianist, you know, people who, just have immense contributions to libertarianism, but ultimately I find their basis for libertarianism to be inconsistent. And that, you know, I just expounded on this in the previous episode about how it's all about consistency. And I think you get that consistency from the fact that there are clearly acts which are moral and clearly acts which are immoral. And you can't get that sense unless you believe in God, at least in some fashion.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that.
Okay, well, it got pretty thick and pretty deep there at the end, so I think we're going to cut it off there. I want to thank you, Nick Gosling, Executive Director of the Libertarian Christian Institute. Nick, where can people better connect with the Libertarian Christian Institute?
So libertarianchristians.com is our website, and that is kind of our main hub. So go on there, subscribe to our email list. You can find links to our podcast and our journal from there as well. We publish new content on the website on a fairly regular basis. You can also follow us on Twitter at LCI Official. We have a pretty sizable Facebook presence. There's both a Facebook page, which you can get linked to from the website, as well as a Facebook group that has currently about 10,000 people in there. And we have some really great discussions in there as well. So those are the main places you can find us. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, or you can find it on YouTube. And you can also support us at libertarianchristians.com/donate.
And I highly recommend that you join and subscribe to all of those as well as donate. I think what you guys are doing is great. It is a wonderful contribution to both Christianity and to libertarianism. So, Nick Gosling, thanks again, and hopefully we can talk again soon.
Thanks, Mike.
All right, that's going to do it for this episode. Make sure you check out the show notes page at battleforliberty.com/51, and there you'll find all of the links that we discussed during this interview. You should be subscribed to the show on iTunes and Stitcher, and if you like what you hear, go on over and leave us a 5-star review at either iTunes or Stitcher. And if you want to do one better, head on over to battleforliberty.com/support and become a supporting member today. You can support the show with as little as $1 per month, and that will help you unlock all sorts of great benefits like members-only posts, behind-the-scenes photos, and even bonus podcast episodes. So if you're ready to take the leap and help us keep the show afloat, battleforliberty.com/support. All right, everybody, take care, and until next time, battle on.